Was there a sense at that time that, the music was really expanding and that, what came next with Cream and Hendrix, like that it was on
Yeah,
the.
well, the shocks for me, the shock waves were Hendrix first. That was the major thing that shook everybody up over here. Even though we'd all established ourselves as, fairly safe in the guitar field, he came along and reset all the rules in one evening, So the next thing you know is that Eric's joined Cream, and it's all kicking off in big chunks. But me, I was left with nothing really. That was the hurtful part, that I didn't have anything to come back at them with.
Right.
The time went by, and I got scraped by with Cozy for a while, and then luckily enough, I got with BBA, which was a power trio thing.
Right.
That did help because they were so enthusiastic, and it was like Cream on acid,
Right,
fantastic.
right.
So then George comes in, and we start mellowing down a bit, and making more classy sort of music, I suppose you could say.
Well, another thought I had was, around the time of 1969, 1970,
Yeah.
and I guess more accurately, probably just after that, Miles Davis was having all these guitar players, and this is not in no way a dig at John McLaughlin because he's, a genius and one of my
Yeah.
favorite, brilliant
Absolutely.
beyond belief. But so many guitar players were really. And at Miles' direction, he would say, "Play like Hendrix."
Yeah.
Like Mike Stern told me, that's what Miles would say to him every day. He'd just say, "Play like Hendrix." So I
Wow.
wondered if there was ever any compulsion or connection to, for you to hook up with Miles just because of what was
Well,
going on in music.
he was so, in my mind's eye, and still is, so far up there in the jazz sort of, he's in a gold-plated place, in the jazz world. Never really not took much notice of, apart from the Jack Johnson, the actual bizarre combination of him asking, having a shred guitar player on there. He was one of those natural spirits that let people do what they want.
Right.
And I'm surprised to hear that he wanted everybody to sound like Jimmy, because nobody does.
Right.
And it's good to hear John kicking him. You can hear that a lot of what's on the Jack Johnson album is
Yeah.
John pushing, pushing. And I think that's a great way of sleight of hand on Miles's part to get the vibe from someone else, and then you sit on top of that.
Right.
So it's sort of like a recirculating kind of power going on. Yeah, would have loved to. More
It
than
never
anything.
got, it was never brought up, or it didn't.
No, it wasn't. I don't know if he even knew I was. But I would, if he would come back, I'd definitely knock on his door,
Just to go back this for a second, we were just from talking about Hendrix. I did a few interviews with Woody over the years, and he talked about when you guys played the Scene Club in New York for a week,
Yeah.
and that Jimmy would come down just about every night.
Yeah, we had 6 nights there. And the thing that brightened it up for me was that we'd all, the initial gig that I think broke us in no small way was the Grateful Dead gig in the Fillmore East. But after that success and the great write-up, we had, then had to go down market into a small club for 6 nights. And so it gave everybody a chance to watch what they'd just seen again, 6 times.
Right.
If you get my drift, that we didn't really want to be scrutinized to that
Right.
extent, in case we were just happened to get lucky on that night.
Right.
But I think the first night Jimmy didn't come, but then he came for the rest of the 5 nights. Around about halfway mark, he'd come from wherever his recording he'd been doing, and the buzz was incredible. The place was packed. Anyway, but when he came in, they were standing on each other's shoulders,
Right.
and he sometimes didn't have his guitar and turned up my guitar upside, one of my spare guitars upside down, and just played it. I actually played bass at one point because he didn't have a guitar, so I gave him mine. I've got a photograph of Thank God that somebody took a picture, because there was, like I said earlier, there was no, hardly any record of those goings on. At Top Village, where we played,
Daytop
where
Village,
Jeremy,
that was the drug rehabilitation
yeah,
center.
we played a secret gig there. Yeah.
Right.
Jimmy drove me up in his Corvette. That was the best moment. The best moment.
I heard his driving was dodgy.
Terrible. Terrible. Yeah, we were stuck in traffic in New York, and he's got this brand new 427 Corvette boiling over, and I thought, I hope it doesn't blow up here.
Right. That's it.
But why did he buy a Corvette in Manhattan?
Right, right. I think you've said this in other interviews, but can you say a little bit about just sort of your relationship with Jimmy, or the just sort of the whatever effect it might have had on you as a musician, or just in a broader sense? I don't know. You know?
I wasn't looking for compliments, but somebody told me that he already knew, but this is before I met him. They said, oh, he knows all about the Yardbirds, and he had to, because somebody who so utterly flamboyant and played so inventively, I knew he was one for listening out. You know, he wasn't one of those sort of staid, very kind of insular kind of blues players. He
right.
listened.
Right.
And that alone thrilled me. He'd obviously seen the Yardbirds in 65, 66 when he was playing sidemen to Little Richard, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And just amazing to see him. I hadn't met him before I saw him. And I saw him in this tiny little club in London with all these dolly birds, you know, they would call them dolly birds,
mm-hmm.
their little mini skirts and all that. And I think they all thought he was going to be a sort of a folky Bob Dylan character.
Right.
And he blows up the place apart with like a Rolling Stone. And I just went, oh, this is so great. It overshadowed any feelings of, you know, inferiority or anything like that. It was so amazing.
Right.
To have somebody do what you wanted to, one wanted to do.
Right.
It was like, I felt like, saying to everybody, this is what I wanted to do, you know, and I came out sort of crestfallen a little bit, but the positive side was that there was this guy opening up big doors for us.
Yeah.
Instead of looking on the negative side saying we're finished, I was thinking, no, we've just started.
Right, right.
We've just started, and I was delighted to have known him for the short time that I did, and it was the magical watering hole of the speakeasy that enabled that in London. There was a club called the Speakeasy.
Right, mm-hmm.
Which was closed down because punks moved in and they started knife fights and stuff like that.
Right.
Sadly, it closed. It was the one place where you could go and guarantee to see somebody, you know, like Eric or Jimmy would be there.
Right.
And have fun playing. And those places don't seem to exist anymore.
Right, right. But he was a warm guy?
Absolutely, yeah. He used to get cross sometimes when if he knew that somebody had potential and he didn't use it. We'd sit there listening to the various bands
right.
in different clubs, and he would look at me without even saying a word. He'd frown or smile according to the phrase.
Right, right.
It was just, you didn't have to say a whole lot. You knew exactly what he was thinking.
Right.
And I miss him dearly, you know.
Yeah.